Washington Week, news and analysis. I'm Neil Strausser, CBS News, reporting on the CBS Radio Network.
Our distinguished guests and my fellow Americans, I proudly present to you the man whose name I will submit to the Congress of the United States for confirmation as the Vice President of the United States, Congressman Gerald Ford of Michigan.
It was, President Nixon proclaimed Friday night, time for a new beginning for America. For the president, it was a new beginning on patching up his tattered relations with Congress, an opportunity created out of the tragedy of the man who was, until Wednesday of this week, the Vice President of the United States. On that day, Spiro Agnew, who had declared he would not resign even if indicted, did resign, pleaded no contest to income tax evasion, and was fined $10,000. Agnew explaining.
The reason that I have changed my decision to fight this matter is because that I believe it would be against the national interest, have a brutalizing effect on my family to go through a long 2-year struggle concerning this matter.
To the end, Agnew denied bribery and conspiracy charges, but the Justice Department, as part of the deal with his lawyers, insisted on making public what amounted to a 40-page indictment, alleging that kickback payments from Maryland contractors continued even through Agnew's first 4 years as vice president. Nevertheless, said Attorney General Richardson, the penalty exacted was high enough.
I'm firmly convinced that in all the circumstances, leniency is justified. I am keenly aware, first, of the historic magnitude of the penalties inherent in the Vice President's resignation from his high office and his acceptance of a judgment of conviction for a felony. To propose that a man who has suffered these penalties should, in addition, be incarcerated in a penal institution, however briefly, is more than I, as head of the government's prosecuting arm, can recommend or wish.
With the resignation of Agnew, the 25th Amendment provision for filling the vacancy for the first time came into play. The Democratic-controlled Congress, by majority vote, to confirm the president's choice of a successor. The Congress spoke with many voices, but there was one common theme, that there was now an opportunity to help heal the wounds of Watergate, restore confidence, and bring the nation together again. Democrat Hubert Humphrey.
I'm hopeful that the president will send to the Congress a nomination that is relatively nonpartisan, a person that will not be a candidate in 1976, and someone around whom we can rally.
Humphrey said any likely contender for the presidential nomination in 1976 should be ruled out. A good many others, like Democrat Henry Jackson, said not every contender, just former Texas Governor John Connally.
Someone who's just switched parties, who's obviously primarily concerned about 1976 in its totality, I think would not be a unifying force. I don't think the Republicans would be happy, and I don't think the Democrats would be happy. He has his problems in both political parties, and I think it would be a mistake.
With such advice ringing in his ears, Mr. Nixon went off to Camp David to ponder a list of suggestions some 300 names long. And Friday night, to the applause of congressional leaders of both parties, he announced his choice, the Republican leader of the House, Gerald Ford. Ford was a partisan, to be sure, but highly respected on both sides of the aisle, and he stressed in his acceptance and later statements that he would devote himself to working with the Congress.
It seems to me that we want in America a united America. I hope I have some assets that might be helpful in working with the Congress and doing what I can throughout our country to make America a united America. And I pledge to you my full efforts, and I pledge the same to my colleagues and to the American people. Thank you very much.
The popularity of the Ford nomination helped ease what had developed as a problem for the Senate's venture into the unexplored territory of ratifying a vice presidential choice. Bruce Morton reports.
The House decided early and easily to send the nomination to its Judiciary Committee for hearings and to act separately from the Senate. The Senate, for a time, couldn't decide what to do. The Democratic and Republican leadership wanted the nomination to go to the Rules Committee. But younger, activist Democrats thought Rules was ill-equipped for investigative work, lacking in staff, experience, pizzazz. In the Democratic caucus, they pushed through a plan to expand Rules, adding 3 Democrats and 3 Republicans. On the Senate floor, as the president's speech drew near, it was clear the liberals didn't have the votes. But they staved off any decision until after the nominee was announced. John Connolly's name would have kept them fighting, but Gerald Ford is not a center of controversy, and the fight collapsed Saturday morning. Democrats emerging from another caucus all smiles. The nomination went off to Rules. That committee met, and Chairman Howard Cannon told reporters afterward the committee had asked the FBI for a full report on Ford, expected to take some 2 weeks, had asked for data from other government agencies, planned a full investigation, and had voted to allow live radio and television coverage of the nomination hearings. Those broadcast hearings will give Americans who don't live in Grand Rapids or Washington a chance to get to know Ford, but they're not likely to be very hot stuff. Democrats and Republicans were singing Ford's praises Friday night and over this weekend. The nastiest word anyone used about him was one Democrat's comment, mediocre. Neil?
And so Agnew, the law and order advocate, and foe of the Eastern establishment, was now inoperative, and the president, with his choice of Ford, seemed to have made the best of a situation which had, as in the case of the Watergate-inspired resignations, again called into question his criteria for choosing his associates. But there were other problems. One, a legacy of Watergate, a federal appeals court ruling that the president is not above the law and cannot withhold pertinent sections of those tape-recorded conversations from the grand jury. Mr. Nixon, at week's end, now facing the decision of whether to appeal to the Supreme Court. And throughout this hectic week, there was the ever more pressing problem of the war in the Middle East. Now clearly no lightning conflict as in 1967, but one taking a heavy toll on both sides. The Russians were airlifting supplies to Egypt and Syria and encouraging other Arab nations to join the fighting. The U.S. moved to make good Israel's munitions losses. Secretary of State Kissinger clinging to the hope, however, that the Soviet-American detente had not been destroyed.
We did not consider the airlift of military equipment helpful. We also do not consider that Soviet actions, as of now, constitute the irresponsibility that on Monday evening, I pointed out, would threaten detente. When that point is reached, we will, in this crisis, as we have in other crises, not hesitate to take a firm stand.
The threat of an Arab move to cut off the flow of Middle Eastern oil led President Nixon to another call for approval of his energy program.
The United States, as a great industrial power, cannot continue to be dependent upon an uncertain source for energy, which could be cut off at any time. That is why one of the major goals of this nation must be to become self-sufficient in energy.
Even without the Arab threat, the administration faced a shortage of heating oil this winter, severe enough to bring the proclamation of allocation controls to begin November 1st. And even in his apparent moment of triumph Friday night, Mr. Nixon may have created a new problem in some quarters as he finished summing up the criteria for the vice presidential selection.
These were the considerations that I had in mind as I considered what man or other individual to select as the nominee for Vice President of the United States.
This Washington Week was produced by other individual Ellen Wadley. I'm Neil Strauser, CBS News.